It's good to be with you here today, and I'm excited about presenting some of the results from my doctoral dissertation that I finished in 2008 under the helpful mentorship of Dr. Staver, John Staver, who just presented prior to me. I want to present a little bit of a context about what you see around or with regards to evolution education in the research literature. There's plenty of discussion on cognitive issues in terms of students' understanding and the rationale they use to try to come to an understanding of evolution. A lot centers on pedagogical issues in terms of the teaching and strategies you can use, such as teaching the nature of science. Plenty of subjects to deal with in terms of high school students all the way up to teachers, and then faculty, graduate students, and so forth. And there's been a lot of methods that have been used in terms of surveys and measures of understanding and measures of acceptance. However, I would suggest that there's been limited naturalistic inquiry. That is, there's been very little of what we call qualitative research, which seeks to explore and understand what is going on in the minds of students, especially those with religious beliefs, as they encounter evolution, and why they are sometimes so resistant to learning about evolution. So in the context of where I teach, I think there's a greater need to understand for students at a Christian university what are their perspectives on creationism and evolution, what are the factors that influence those perspectives, and to look at this not only from a cognitive framework, but from an affective framework as well. And that is where the faith development perspective comes in that I'll introduce a little bit later in my talk. The central question of my study was, how do Christian biology-related majors at a Christian university reconcile evolution and their personal religious beliefs? And there are four sub-questions that drove the study. What were those factors that influenced their perspectives? What were their extant views on evolution and creationism? And then also, what aspects of their personal religious beliefs created dissonance with their understanding and acceptance of evolution? And then what I'm going to focus on today is, what role does participants' faith play out in this reconciliation process? So I utilized a naturalistic methodology where I was trying to discover meaning and patterns that lead to a greater understanding of this phenomenon that's going on within the students' minds. The study setting was at a Christian university in the Midwest of around 1,200 students, fairly conservative in the Wesleyan tradition. And a denomination with which the school is associated remains neutral with respect to evolution as long as God is acknowledged as the creator. However, I determined in my study that an overwhelming majority of the students, when they entered into the university, had very strong anti-evolution attitudes, and the strong majority were young earth creationists. So I gathered data in the spring and summer of 2007. My selection criteria was for biology-related majors, that is, those majoring in biology, biochem, and preparation for medical school, and also science education majors. They had to complete a course called Origins, which is mostly a study of cosmological, geological, but mostly actually biological evolution. And because they didn't complete this course until relatively late in their junior year, the participants in my study were seniors. And then to expand the sample size, I also included recent biology-related majors who had graduated within the last 2 years. So I had 15 study participants, 7 were seniors and 8 were recent graduates. 12 of them were females and 11 were in the same denomination as the university. I was a professor there at the university during the time of this research, and I'd had many of these participants previously in my physics or science ed courses. However, none of the participants were in any of my courses at the time of the research or afterwards following the data collection. In terms of the qualitative data that I collected, I conducted 2 semi-structured interviews. One was on faith development. The other one was on creationism and evolution. I also gathered papers they had written in the Origins course. These were called scholarly papers, which was written at the very end of the course by the students that was a summary of their views about evolution and also its interactions with their personal religious beliefs. They filled out an evolution attitude survey, and I also took extensive field notes during the Origins course in one spring. Now, this is qualitative data analysis, so I don't have a lot of statistics to give to you, but I'll be using words like most, which means 10 or greater, but not all 15 of the participants, many, which means 5 or more, but less than most, and then some, which is with regards to less than 5. So let's get right to the study findings. It turns out that the studies show that most of the participants that came in were raised to believe in young earth creationism. Only one of them held this notion of theistic evolution. And I hope you'll allow me to use that term. I know there's alternative terms, such as evolutionary creationism. But this term, theistic evolution, is used quite a bit in the science education literature, so I'll go ahead and use that term here today. So at the time of the study, only one still retained that strong embracing of young earth creationism. Another participant had transitioned to progressive creationism with some elements of theistic evolution. This participant suggested that God started out with a special act of creation in an initial line of maybe 10,000 species, and from there, evolution took over. So that means that the remaining 13 had actually transitioned over to theistic evolution. What was surprising to me was that 14 out of the 15 accepted human evolution. So what were those influences on their views? Well, as they're growing up, obviously parents were a very, very strong influence. Most raised them to believe in young earth creationism. And many parents actually continued to actively pressure their students, their own sons and daughters, to reject evolution, even while they are learning about it in the Origins classroom. For example, one student, who I'll call Rachel, recalled heated exchanges she had with her father. They would argue, and she recalls a gist of his comments. "Why are you thinking this way? We sent you off to a Christian school, and you're learning all this liberal garbage?" She remarked that the arguments with her father never degenerated into hatred, but did create, as she described it, kind of a space between us. In fact, she wrote in her scholarly paper, "I have to ask God to give me patience to not hate the men who caused me and my dad to argue about origins. I think if they could just realize that science is not out to destroy God, then maybe they would give it a chance." So parents continue to be strong influences, but yet students had moved beyond maybe that influence and were seeking a worldview of their own. And in the context, in the milieu of the university, it turned out that professors were influential role models as well. So the participants respected professors who were genuine and forthright in presenting evolution in a Christian context, and especially those that demonstrated a commitment to finding a positive relationship between science and religious beliefs. This was important because they'd never thought, prior to coming to the university, that a Christian could accept evolution. Again, Rachel comes into play when she stated, "You knew she believed it. This is the origins professor. You knew she believed it about God, but then she also talked about evolution, and so you kind of had to reconcile the two. My whole life, it was just two things that were separate, and they must stay separate. But with her, they came together, and you had to reconcile them." So this is the importance of the person, of the role model standing in front of them. And there was a comment earlier about, you know, various denominations and statements they've made, organizations, and those are important, but at least for these students, it was important to see a person acting it out, somebody in real life right in front of them dealing with these issues. Now, it wasn't easy for them to transition to an acceptance of theistic evolution. In fact, it was fraught with conflict resolution and apprehension. It was a deeply personal journey, and many articulated the struggle they faced in reforming their old habits of thinking. Coming to an acceptance of evolution was not a simple matter of considering the scientific evidence and then judging its merit. Instead, many participants had to reorder and sort through competing interests in deciphering how evolution could fit within their worldview. For example, Ashley grew up in a home that was strongly young earth creationist. She expressed a personal sense of shock in first learning that a Christian could actually accept evolution, and she said, "Now, you see what I mean about being blindsided and bombarded with things like that for 18 or 19 years that you've held true? I mean, to me, it's almost like for 23 years believing that my mom and dad are my parents, and then one day them saying, 'No, you're adopted.' That's kind of how it was for me, just as true for so long, and then you're just like, 'What?' It was that out of the blue to me." She said that learning about evolution, and I quote, "was a combination of your thoughts for so many years being shattered, and then you're picking up pieces here and there, and then adding your own." So what were these factors that helped them transition to this acceptance of evolution? Well, the evidence of evolution, they were science majors, was incontrovertible in their minds. They also had to negotiate the Genesis creation narratives as non-literal, and they had to come to some point where they recognized that their salvation was unlinked to an acceptance of evolution, because many had grown up in a context where the two of them were held in antithesis to each other. And finally, as I mentioned earlier, observing Christian professors modeled this commitment to evolution. So even though these are not scientific issues per se, they had to also deal with some of the theological ramifications. They postulated theological purpose, pragmatically approached the issue of theodicy, and they affirmed a belief in the soul. Now, let me jump back here to this idea of faith development perspective and taking a look at not just the cognitive framework, but an effective framework as well. James Fowler was a developmental psychologist who described faith as the cognitive rationale and effective response for shaping and making meaning of one's world and deciding those things that are ultimately true and dependable. Sharon Parks, who worked with university students in trying to better understand their faith, wrote that faith is one's conviction about the ultimate character of truth, of self, and of the world. I want to be very emphatic here in stating that this idea of faith, as put forward by Fowler and then later on by Parks, is not to be confused with our ideas of faith like within the church, our own beliefs, or faith as a gift from God. But rather, it's stages of development, stages of ways of thinking, much like you might see with Puget's model and so forth. So Fowler put together, and his interviews and getting to know people and seeing in various phases of their lives, looking at characteristics by which he saw six distinct phases. And he looked at various reasoning abilities, logic, social awareness, moral judgment, along the works with like Lawrence Kohlberg and so forth, and then Erickson in terms of social perspective and identity and so forth, looking at the locus of authority, whether it's within or without, based on other people, a variety of things to help distinguish between these various stages. And I want to focus on the two stages here, stage three and stage four, being the synthetic, conventional, and the individuative, reflective. Let me focus first on that first one. Now, if you have any adolescents in your home or teenagers, you know exactly what I'm talking about, where they see the world and tend to be very conformist, the importance of interpersonal relationships. The authority really lies in significant others, those that may be charismatic personalities or in symbols of power to them. They're very accepting of group values, and they conform to the convention. Their ideas are tacit and assumed. Dualistic thinking, black and white, they really haven't critically reflected. But maybe if a person goes through some kind of transition or through some kind of crisis where they recognize that this value system doesn't really work in the real world or in a difficult situation, that crisis may move them on to be more reflective and arrive at this stage where there's more of a critical reflection of their personal identity and their own beliefs. It's more of an explicit system. And they transition some of that authority to within themselves. I mentioned Sharon Parks earlier, and she studied college students' faith and described the progression during university years. And she noticed that there was an intermediate transition stage between stage three and stage four that she called young adult faith. It's marked by relativism, where students go through this reordering of the constructs about the world. That is, persons who operate in this young adult faith are in the midst of testing new ideas, probing until they reach a more defined and equilibrated sense of their own belief systems. And in doing so, incorporate more of the self as a source of authority and also broaden the groups to which they associate and belong. So she called that young adult faith. So when you take a look here at the spectrum between three and four, including the young adult faith in between, and then overlay that with the faith stage analysis that I did on the participants, you see they follow through the entire gamut right there across the spectrum. Then we take a look at the 13 that embrace theistic evolution. They're spread out there as well. The one that was a progressive creationist, she's up there transitioning towards an adult faith. And then I want you also to concentrate a little bit on David here, who was a young earth creationist but firmly entrenched in conventional faith. Now, the purpose of the study was not to correlate their faith somehow to the degree that they accepted evolution. Instead, I wanted to see how faith, took part in that mediation process in terms of reconciling evolution and their personal religious beliefs. So David, in terms of his conventional faith, he really displayed very little tolerance for ambiguity. Everything was black and white, right or wrong for him. There was a lack of perspective taking. The world operated according to his framework, and he couldn't see the opposite argument and see things from other people's perspectives. He also, even though he never acknowledged it, there was this undercurrent of this fear of change, and he associated evolution with Darwinism and the atheistic effects on society. But those that operated with an adult faith stage really had moved beyond these ideas, and they were able to take other people's perspectives into account and recognize that things aren't so black and white, and there's often complexity in the world around them. adult faith stage participants were deferential to the scientific evidence, where conventional faith stage participants tended to disregard some of the scientific evidence. And again, David is a good example of this, where he assimilated ideas that were anti-evolution, and then he ignored the scientific evidence for evolution. I'll try to show that to you with this little animated GIF right here. So he'd done a lot of reading with anti-evolution. And so whenever he came across these ideas, you can see the net closed in and he latched onto those ideas. He assimilated those ideas. But when it came to scientific evidence for evolution, as those came along, the net opens up and it passes right on through. This was the cognitive framework, the filter that he was actually using. Now, he practically admitted this as much in his Origins paper, and he said, "I follow the Bruce Lee philosophy, keep what is useful, discard what is useless." So you can see here he's using this idea to kind of filter what he wants to hear. An amazing thing was that this was not only with the scientific evidence, but it was also those sources of authority. Because he was in the same class as his Origins professor, a trained entomologist for 35 years and a Christian, but yet he tended to not let her have any significant impact on the way that he saw life or the way that he saw evolution. So it was not just the evidence, it was also those that were in front of him in terms of role models. Also, the adult faith stage participants displayed this nuanced approach where conventional faith participants tended to avoid any confrontation because they didn't like the ambiguity. Now, this is a little bit complicated, but this is the standard Piagetian model of accommodation and assimilation. I think it works well, like in a classroom. So you start on the classroom, you have these existing ideas that you bring, right? We've already heard that idea discussed this morning. You have a new encounter, you see new evidence, then you have to sort through your existing ideas and kind of reorder what's going on there. So you might go through a process of assimilation where existing ideas tend to have a good fit with what you're experiencing, and then you can exit out of there with a reinforcement. Now, that could be good or bad. Like, for instance, Michael had already pretty much dealt with evolution and personal religious beliefs prior to the Origins classroom. So once he was in the classroom, he stated that evolution didn't worry me. If it matches the rest of your faith, then there's not much to be scared of. So it was very easy for him to assimilate new ideas because they fit very well within his structures. But what about David? He assimilates as well. Because when he comes across, as I showed you earlier, perceived evidence against evolution, he assimilates those ideas, as we've already seen, because he embraces what he wants to and then reinforces what I would claim would be a wrong idea within his mind. If he comes across any disequilibrium at all, that means that there's an incomplete fit, this new encounter with his existing ideas, what did he do? Well, he tended to, when he came across evidence for evolution, he just opted out of the learning process. In fact, he stated, "Especially as much as I'd already read, I already knew the points of evolution they're going to bring up and the supposed facts they're trying to bring up to support it. It just didn't hold up." He had already made this conclusion prior to coming to the Origins classroom. So his existing ideas were unchanged. He just opened up the net and let those ideas fly on through. Now, other conventional faith stage participants operated in unique ways when they encountered this disequilibrium. They knew what the right answer was. Evolution is valid, and it should fit within a Christian framework. But they had not worked through this process, which resulted then in a false accommodation for them. A good example of this was Diana, who operated with conventional faith. Now, she embraced theistic evolution. However, listen to how little nuance there is in her understanding of science and faith. She stated, "My religious beliefs and my scientific beliefs go hand in hand. I don't ever separate the two. I don't think that they're two different worlds. This world is one big science and religion ball. It works together." And then emphatically, it has to. You see that forced accommodation. It has to. She went on, and it gets a little long here, but it's worth stating. "I don't think you should null and void chapter 1 through 11. No, it's not like that. I think science starts on day 1, Genesis 1, and the Bible starts on Genesis 1. And there's no just taking that part out. It's not, well, I think it all happened, and all happened in some way, shape, and form. There's got to be a way to explain it. There has to be, and I believe that." Again, there has to be. And I think it's something that I would just have to study way more into, but I don't know. And it keeps going on and on like that. Because she knew what the right answer was, but she really hadn't worked through her ideas to come through some kind of true accommodation. So it was a false accommodation. Existing ideas had been changed, but yet the tensions remained, even if she wasn't willing to confront them interconventional faith stage. So the idea, hopefully, what we're after in the science classroom is that through accommodation, you restructure your existing ideas to fit the experience, even though it's not going to be easy. We want them to change their previous ideas if they're incorrect and find a greater sense of equilibrium. So Jennifer was a good example of this, working in adult faith stage. I believe, she stated, that everything I wanted to believe will make perfect sense and fit within the exact boundaries of the place I've carved out for it. She has these ideas, and she recognizes she's doing some metacognition there, if you will. But I can't force something to fit that doesn't. I could change my view to allow it to fit, but sometimes it seems a lot harder than it seems. So she's stating that's a difficult process. She was in this crucible of cognitive and affective dissonance. She recognized that she couldn't force a fit between her old ideas and her emerging views on evolution. So in acting on adult faith, she chose a more difficult task and did what she recognized she must do, change her views to accommodate evolution and thus find greater equilibrium. So this is a poignant quote I really like here. It says, "Even one's grip has to accommodate to a stone while clay is assimilated within our grip." This is what's going on within the minds of our students. You can see here that the evidence for evolution within Jennifer's mind was like a stone. She had to accommodate it. She used her adult faith to change her ideas to fit the evidence where the evidence led. Whereas the evidence within David's mind was like clay. Operating in a conventional faith, he simply changed his perceptions of the evidence to fit his existing schema, to leave it unchanged. So what might be the relevance then for university professors? And I know this took place within the context of a Christian university, so for those who are at secular universities, I would suggest they just need to condition it to their appropriate and their specific circumstances. But the importance of that role model, for the professor to have an open and honest dialogue that deals with all these complexities in the relationship between science and religious beliefs, to take a look at the theological ramifications. In fact, Arthur Holmes, who wrote the idea of a Christian college, states, "Students need to gain a realistic look at life and discover for themselves the questions that confront us. They need to work their way painfully through the maze of alternative ideas and arguments while finding out how Christian religious faith speaks to such matters. They need a teacher as a catalyst and a guide." And then this idea about faith, too, as a means of understanding how students actually approach and counteract some of these ideas that we might present about evolution. And it requires great patience on our part. If you ask Piaget, he'd never say that you need to push a person through their, you know, cognitive framework, through those stages of development. It takes time. So it's easy for me sometimes, even though I myself went through similar processes, you know, in during my college years and afterwards. It's easy for me, now that I'm on this side, how difficult it was. And we need to remember that's not an easy task for our students. I really appreciate the title of our symposium today, and that is Seeking God's Wisdom for Science Teaching. Because it takes humility to recognize the difficulties we face in teaching. But more so, it requires wisdom to understand the challenges our students face in learning about evolution. But we as teachers, as role models and fellow sojourners on the path to understanding, can, through God's wisdom enabling, help our students find reconciliation between evolution and their personal religious beliefs. Thank you. Thank you.